Hello, I have Lynn Lifshin on the phone. How are you doing, Lynn?
Hi, Belinda. It's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, we have talked before. Let's see. You were here in El Paso back in...
It was 2002.
Right, and you were the guest poet at the community college here.
Right, in El Paso, and I went from there on to do something at AWP, and that was a great time. That was really fun.
So you enjoyed El Paso?
I did. I loved it.
Oh,
you know?
Great.
I love the students, and I've kept in touch with a few of them.
Well, great. Do you know Leslie X? That's okay if you don't.
Yes, of course I do.
Okay,
yes,
well,
yes.
Yeah, she's kind of a butt of mine a little bit.
Yes, and she's really energetic.
Yeah,
she was great.
Well, I hope you get back here again, and maybe let me host you this time.
I would love to. I'll come tomorrow.
Okay, well, I could arrange something maybe in the not too distant future.
That would be really great.
And the last time we talked on the phone, let's see, that would have been 88
in March.
Yeah. Well, tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, it was so funny because I was doing a radio program. It was on a Clear Channel station, WGY, with Art Murphy, and we had made a plan to call you, and you were in Germany then, weren't you?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yes, and it was just a really funny moment. But I remember, I don't know if we woke you up or something, but the host, Art Murphy, was convinced that you were sleeping and you would just stumble downstairs in your nightgown or something. And I remember we talked about the fact that your then sister-in-law was looking for a husband.
Oh, yeah.
And he volunteered himself, kind of, but he didn't want to eat. He said he wanted to eat meat. And, you know, she was a vegetarian. And I remember you said... She would cook meat for him.
Right, my Indian in-laws at the time.
Yeah.
Right. Well, actually, it was like 3 in the morning there.
I thought so.
And I had camped out next to the phone, but I guess I was a little drowsy.
It was very funny.
I thought our listeners might be interested in how we came into contact with each other. Would you tell us a little bit about
that? Yes, it was such a strange... It was so strange. I had been writing... Well, first of all, out of the blue, I began getting... was working with the Pope in the Vatican, and it was so amazing to get, you know, here I am, you know, just a person getting that spiritual, I thought, and that, you know, close to the Pope. And it was, their letters were so nice, and I'm sort of obsessive about answering mail, so I answered very quickly, and then I would get another letter. And each letter began to get just a little more, how would you put it, seductive, and a little more, a little more sexy. And finally, they were getting to the point where they were getting really quite hot.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was getting photographs. And it was just amazing. He was a very attractive man, and he would send photographs with him sort of naked to the waist and with his motorcycle, and one of them shaking hands with the Pope. And during this time, I began writing poems about him because I thought, how could I possibly be, you know, have a man like that interested in me? But very soon I found that another editor who was doing another magazine, Lips Magazine, was so strange. She said to me, can you do a reading a particular date? And at that time, I said, well, you know, I think I might possibly be having a guest come from Italy. And she said, from Italy? And I said, yes. And she said, not from the Vatican. And it turned out that he was writing to her also. But she's not much of a letter writer, so she never answered that quickly. So her mail didn't escalate like mine did. But it turned out she was also writing to him. And around this time, I think I sent you some poems.
Mm-hmm.
And you were also getting pictures, too.
Yeah, as I recall, just from what you said in your poems, you mentioned Vatican, you mentioned, I think, the first name. I don't even know if you mentioned the first name. But anyway, you said Jesuit, Vatican.
I might have mentioned long hair.
Long hair. He likes long hair poets, sexy letters. And I just wrote back and said, would his first name perhaps be, and I said it.
Uh-huh.
And then you wrote back, wow, he's writing you too.
and suddenly, you know, instead of feeling like really honored, I began to feel like, wait a minute, he's two-timing me. You know?
Well, he's 3, 4, 5 times.
And, you know, since then, I mean, the letters, first of all, I think because I'm, as I say, I'm so obsessive about mail, I think I probably got the most racy letters of any. In fact, it was sort of funny because I went to a writer's conference around that time, and it was clear, it was up in Rochester, and it was clear they cared nothing about poetry. But when I said, you know, they just, to them, poetry didn't matter. But then suddenly I brought out the fact that I was getting letters from the Vatican, and suddenly people who couldn't care a bit began talking and listening to me. And then suddenly they were all glued to me, and they just wanted to know more, and they said, you should send these to, oh, the person who's doing The Hustler. And, you know, suddenly I was, like, important. I had a real piece of information and a lot of, you know, things that would make great, great, very popular, you know, reading. So it was really funny, but, you know, I kept up with this, and then finally, I don't know, how did you stop? How did it slow down? I don't know.
Well, I think he caught on that we knew that he was writing to us,
right,
and also to other people, because we started, especially you, started writing poetry that,
yes,
talked about.
Yes, I did
about,
a lot.
Yeah, I did a few. In fact, didn't we do a chapbook together?
We did a chapbook together.
Yeah.
That Gerald Townsend published.
Yeah, the Jesuit poems.
The Jesuit poems, right.
Yeah, and I think that ticked him off, and he just sort of quit writing. Plus, he knew we knew about him, so he wasn't that
right.
interested. I have to give him credit for his idea about a lifesaver, which wasn't
oh,
me,
yes.
but to another lady, perhaps
that
you.
It was to me, yes.
I don't know if someone else had thought of that, but to me, at
that
first
was
I'd heard
amazing.
About it.
Yes.
To put a lifesaver at a special place on one's body and
right.
then send it to him. And the interesting thing, besides being like something like the business manager of the Vatican at the time,
right.
he had a vow of chastity or something.
Right. Right.
So I guess it was just that drive that he couldn't express any other way other than we know how it came out.
Well, you know, he did send me money. I mean, now that I think about it, I'm sorry I even cashed it, but he sent me money on the Vatican stationery checks.
Really?
Yes, for something that had been very close to me. And I think I know what he really wanted.
Right.
I sent him books.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we have an idea what he wants. Some people were very close to you.
Right. And then it was, I felt sort of bad. He actually moved really close to me and invited me to have, like, Thanksgiving with him one year. And, you know, it was really strange. I mean, this was not that long ago. And I thought, well, you know, really, he probably is lonely and it's probably hard to leave, you know, the Vatican and come to this country. So I invited him, but before I was going to invite him, but before I had a chance, he took back his invitation, and that was the last I heard of him.
Hmm.
He must have somehow realized that he couldn't do this anymore.
Yeah, well, he was very conflicted, probably.
I think he was. It was sort of too bad, but the one thing that I think is the fact that he was writing to so many women. I mean, I've come across other women, you know, in this area and other areas, and the only thing they had in common, they all had long hair.
Ah.
I think that was the thing. They all had long hair, and they could be blondes or brunettes or redheads, but they had to have long hair. And, you know, I think that was what made me feel sort of like, well, if he could be so unfaithful. You know?
But they were also poets, weren't they?
And they were all poets,
yeah.
too. But who knows? Maybe
yeah.
he went into another field, too.
Okay. Do you have a poem ready to read to us? I have already introduced you so much that you have done, probably one of the most published poets in the universe. But
to some people, it's not, you know, it's not a compliment. But
well, I mean, your writing is good. I mean,
well,
everything
you.
That anyone writes, you know, we all have some stuff that's not so good, but it's the good stuff that gets published. Read one of your favorite poems. Maybe.
Okay, well, I'm going to read a poem that's probably the most anthologized, and it's a little bit longer than anything else I'll read, so I might read it quickly. Okay, it's called The No More Apologizing, The No More Little Laughing Blues. Apologizing for going to school instead of having a job that made money or babies. Pretending I took the bus to an office, paper clips in my ear, and never that I was reading Wyatt, writing my own dreams in the dust under the... Apologizing for my hair, wild gypsy hair that fell out of every clip, the way the life I started dreaming of did. Apologizing for the cats. You know, if someone said my skirt was too short, well, I explained or said sorry, but never that I finally loved my legs. I spent years apologizing for not having babies, laughing when someone my ex-mother-in-law, who happened to be a relative of Philip Roth, pulled the baby Gerber jar out of the closet and held it in front of my eyes like it was a cross or a star. Now, I should have thrown that through the glass. I didn't need to explain the music I liked. One friend said, "Lynn, that's noise." Another looked at me and said, "Isn't denim for children?" Well, I laughed, the apologizing, "Oh, I don't want no trouble" laugh. Over the years, pretending to cook, pretending to like babying my husband. The only place I said what I meant was in poems. That green was like some huge forbidden flower that grew so big it couldn't even fit in the house. Pulled me out a window with it toward Colorado. I apologized for being what they thought a woman was by being flattered when someone said, "You write like a man." And for not being what they thought a woman, for the cats and leaves instead of booties for the poems. When someone said, "How much do you get paid?" You know, I pretended. I couldn't stop trying to please. The A, the star. I practically had "good girl" on my forehead. The spanking clean haunted half my life. But the poems had their own life, and mine finally followed, for the poems were growing. Warm paper skin growing finely in my real bed until the room stopped spinning for good. The way it used to when I dressed up in suits and hairspray, pretending to be all those things I wasn't. Good girl, teacher, lady, and especially wife. I was writing about lovers for years before I'd felt, when I was still making love just on the sheets of paper. When the poems first came out, one woman I drove to school with said, "I can't take this." Another said, "I don't know. This can't be the you I know, so brutal, violent. Which is the real?" The man I was with moved to the other side of the bed. This was worse than not having babies. His mother said they always knew I was odd. My clothes, my hair, but it was mainly the books I brought to bed. They said I never seemed like one of them. My own family thought it was okay, but couldn't I write of things that were pleasant? They wanted to know how much I got paid and why I didn't write for the Atlantic. Look, I still have trouble saying no. I want all of you to care about what I'm thinking, maybe even to want my hair. It's true, I put a no-smoking sign up on the door, but twice I have gone and gotten out ashtrays. But I have stopped being grateful to be asked to read, or to always have some lover right there beside me. It's still not easy to get off the phone, tell a young stone poet. It's a bore to lie there with the phone in my ear like a cold rock. Well, he goes on about the evils of money, charging it to my phone. But now, when I hear myself laughing that apologizing laugh, I know what swallowing those black seeds can do, and I spit them out, just like tobacco. That's something men could always do. Look, nothing good grows from the I'm sorry. Only those dark branches, and they will get you right from inside. Well, it's a poem that I've read a lot in open reading, you know, to open readings. And I know the man I'm with says, I don't want to hear that poem again.
That's great.
Thank you. At first I thought it was only women who liked it, but some men like it too.
Well, a lot of men these days, they're not as macho and kind of, kind of understand women as human beings.
Yeah, and I think everyone gets into the situation where, you know, there's somebody you have to be polite to, and it just kind of carries you up at times.
And we all do it, men and women, you know, we do that.
And I do it still all the time.
Well, we all do it a little bit because to function in the world. And, are you working on something special now, a new collection?
I have, you know, I was really so fortunate to have Black Sparrow for a couple of years. And I have to say, John Martin was just so wonderful to work with. I had two books from him, and I had another one that was supposed to come out in 2002 in September. And that's coming out in... Well, that's a good question. It's been every time, it's on Amazon, and every time I go to look, the date has been pushed up ahead. Right now it says February 2006, and that's called Another Woman Who Looks Like Me. But I actually finished that, you know, a while ago, and so I'm really waiting for that. And I have a book coming out from Red Hen Persephone, and I've had a lot of little chapbooks here and there pretty recently, like Barbie Poems, and just... I have one that's going to be coming up really soon. It's The Daughter I Don't Have from another small press, Plan B Press. And it has a gorgeous cover. The wife of the publisher did it, and it's really an incredible cover. And, you know, I haven't actually started, but I'm thinking of working on I'm planning to work on another selected. So I always have something. Someone is going to do a collection of tsunami poems. It's pretty definite, but I haven't seen the contract yet.
You wrote a bunch of tsunami poems.
I did. It was, you know, it was just really right after it happened, and they were kind of written, you know, in a really short period of time because I was pretty, you know, I'm actually working on some New Orleans hurricane poems, too. They're still in a notebook.
So you live and breathe poetry.
Well, I seem to be drawn to some of the more dark sides, too. I'd like to be able to write some really happy poems. But, you know.
You've got a lot of humorous poems, and we'll get to that in a little bit.
Okay, right.
I wrote one tsunami poem because my ex-father-in-law or some of my ex-family could possibly have been drowned because they were in Calcutta and it really affected that, but also Madras, which I think is called Chennai now, in the Indian Ocean. And I'm out of contact because of my ex being remarried and so jealous that he doesn't even contact his children, much less me. But anyway, I only wrote one, and I was sort of like more directly connected. I have yet to see your documentary film. I ought to go out and get a copy or something.
Oh, well, you know, what's really sad is that it was being distributed by Women Make Movies, and then they kind of stopped distributing it. And the filmmaker has said she has plans for doing it, but, you know, distributing herself or getting another version. But, you know, right now I'm not sure, but... You know, there's probably ways that I could arrange something.
Well, yeah, I'm wondering if it's on DVD and can it be bought?
It isn't on DVD. I made some dubs of it on plain video. And, you know, I should suggest this to the filmmaker because maybe that would sort of, you know, trigger her interest in doing it. That's a great idea.
Yeah, DVD's easy and quick.
That's a great idea. Yeah. I'm gonna mention this. I'm gonna write this down. This is a great idea because we've worked together. She and I worked together. She did the cover of the book I did about poems about New Mexico, and she did the Marilyn Monroe cover. I don't know if you've seen that book, but it's a beautiful. She did a whole lot of. Her name is Marianne Lynch, and she's a photographer and a filmmaker, but mostly doing photography now. But she did all these photographs, like of Marilyn Monroe, you know, things, you know, like photographs that other people had done or drawings on the side of a building. And she did the cover of that book. So we've collaborated on a lot of things, and this is a great idea. I'll mention it.
Well, Gypsy E-Zine does do reviews if you want to send or have your publisher send review copies, or maybe someone who's written a review.
Well, I can definitely send you a review copy of my book about, you know, my ruffian book, The Licorice Daughter, which is exactly the opposite of what happened with my Godin book. I submitted this poem. I became, like, well, many years ago I had a student who had MS, and she took a workshop of mine after checking out to make sure I did it in my house, to make sure she could get to the bathroom. And she was a really lovely woman. And she one day said to me, she was in a wheelchair, she was pretty young, and one day she said to me, she said, you know, I'm like Ruffian. I'm a fighter and I won't give up. And she said, well, you know who Ruffian is. And to tell you the truth, I didn't. So she said, she told me a little bit about the fact that Ruffian was this beautiful filly who had been in a race, and she went on with it. And I think I wrote one poem. This was just around the, this was really quite a while ago. It was around the time that Ruffian actually did her last race. And somehow, in the, around 2003, I began to be obsessed with Ruffian again. And I just got on this thing. You know, I get these obsessions, but the Ruffian obsession was way above all the others.
So Ruffian was a famous racehorse?
Yes, Ruffian was a famous racehorse, an absolutely beautiful, you know, black, almost black filly. And shall I read the introduction just to
the
book?
Yes, and you had a full book about Ruffian.
Yeah, and it started off because, you know, I don't know what it was. I mean, I've never, when I was young and growing up, my sister was, into horses, and my mother, and we would go to horse races, and I would take a book and sit there with, my head in the book. I did not have any interest. I mean, I rode just a little bit. I didn't collect horse statues. I didn't want a horse. And yet, it was actually around 2003, probably around the, June, July, and it was around the time of Funny Side and a couple of other racehorses, and I just kind of wrote a little bit, and then I got into just writing about Ruffian, and for over a year, it was like a real ritual. It was also a difficult time, but I really felt that Ruffian kind of saved my life in a weird way. First of all, every day I read and wrote about her, every day for a year, but nothing else. And I finally got the book together, and I really wasn't sure I'd have a publisher because, horses and poems, I didn't think they'd go together. And I was really lucky. I got a wonderful publisher with Texas Review Press, which isn't probably that far from you, and I'm not sure.
Well, I believe that's Houston, so
it's
we're
Houston,
talking
right.
7 or 8 miles or something. Everything's
right.
Far away from
Texas
me.
Texas the big state. Well, I sent the poem, the book, the manuscript, on November 11th. On December 11th, he accepted it, and it was out on July 11th. However, it has not, because he's part of this Texas consortium, it is not on Amazon, and it's not in the bookstore yet. So I have it as a special order on Amazon, but, I can give you the the 800 number where people can order it, because I have been doing readings from it. But I'll just read a little introduction to her. I just kind of got obsessed with her. I can't explain it. In fact, I really don't know. It's almost like she just took hold of me, almost like a religion or something. And I could barely stop writing about her. And, I went to Saratoga and looked at her plaque on the Racing Hall of Fame, and here's just a little bit of, for people who don't know anything about her, as I didn't, and I think this probably is more of an introduction even than the poems about her. Let's see, I'm going to put, grab, the book was, it has a beautiful cover, and I'm really happy with it. I just wish it would get on Amazon. Okay, this is just a little bit of an introduction to her. On April 17th, 1972, at 10 minutes to 10 in the late evening, 3 days late, the only time she would be, Ruffian was born at Claiborne Farm in Paris, Kentucky. She was born with a star on her forehead, a sign of what she would become. The fastest filly, maybe the greatest horse of all time. From her record-breaking maiden race, she left behind the best fillies and mares in races she won almost effortlessly, as she won stakes and broke records. She was ahead at every point of call. Ruffian was strikingly beautiful, more like his black stallion, the writer Walter Farley said, than any colt he'd seen, the image of the black beauty. An undefeated winner of lightning fast speed, Ruffian was champion juvenile filly of 1974. She was never headed, flew to breathtaking, stunning victories with a stride like no other horse, almost ghostly. Invincible, until just after her Triple Crown win for fillies, it seemed Ruffian didn't know how to lose. Then, in a tragic, misguided match race with the winner of the year's Kentucky Derby, the cult foolish pleasure. She broke down, even then in the lead by nearly a length. Even on three legs, thrusting her broken foreleg into the ground over and over, she could not easily be pulled up. No one who saw her can forget her. Ruffian was rare, perfect, spectacular. She was miraculous, bright, and she is buried where no other horse has been buried, where she ran her first and last race, at the infield at Belmont, under the NYRA flagpole, her nose pointing, as it always did, towards the finish line. And I just got, you know, as I say, I started with other, you know, horses, and with a few other horses, and then I just sort of like got so unbelievably hooked on her that I just, you know, I could not bear to stop writing about her. And it was like I can't even explain it, you know.
Well, are you a horse person?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so there's something about Ruffian.
Something about Ruffian. She was, in a way, at that time, at this race, you know, it was kind of the horses, it was the Billie Jean King, Bobby Riggs time, and there were people who had the horse races that, said the filly, and some said the girl and the boy. And one of the most interesting things that happened during this was that someone who was in Taxi Driver with, all those great stars, Robert De Niro and other people, and the man who played the taxi driver, said he was in New York that summer, and that he was, you know, trying to figure out what is a taxi driver really, really like. And what he did was he got into a cab with one guy, and he saw the guy was wearing a Ruffian button. So he got a Ruffian button too, and he sent me a photograph wearing the Ruffian button in Taxi Driver, which I would never have probably seen, but it was really amazing. I have it on my mantle now, and
oh.
I can read one short poem.
Yes,
that's about, you know, I sort of, in the book I kind of trace her, you know, her birth and her, you know, her, she was just an incredible horse and just, you know, funny and proud, and everyone thought she was a colt. But this is a poem about that last day when she did break down. On that day, it was as if she had wings, and then the wings turned to wax, were melting. There was a hush, seconds after the wild cheers as Ruffian edged ahead. It was hot and the roses were dripping. The sun kept on as it did with Icarus falling from the sky on melting wings. The birds didn't stop. When her jockey pulled her up that last night, everyone who knew must have covered their eyes. They say that after that, racing took a deep breath and never stopped exhaling. And I did a reading last week up in New York, and it was amazing. There was this guy who, I'm sure, had never gone to a poetry reading. You know, he was like, I'm sure he'd never read any poetry, but he was a real horse fan. And I think he was there to kind of trip me up, because I don't know that much about horses. I have to keep reading more and more, you know. I have to keep up with it, you know, like I was studying. But, you know, I'm also fascinated by it. And he kept asking me questions. And after I got done, he said, "Girl, you do know right well your horses." And he also said that after Ruffian died, there was no beauty in horse racing. It was just the money. Mm. So it's, it's sort of a sad story, but, you know, it's also it's a beautiful story, too, because she really became myth afterwards. You know, she was like Marilyn Monroe or, you know, any of the people who die young.
I wonder if I almost had a chance to see her back in the early 80s, she would have been racing?
No, she died in 75.
Oh, 75. Well,
yeah.
I didn't have a chance because I used to live not so far from Bowling Green, Kentucky, there for a year, and we were going to go to...
I remember that.
Yeah, but I didn't go. And anyway, I wouldn't have seen her anyway.
Well, you know, I was really close to where she was. She raced only, I think, once, at least once, but I think just once in Saratoga, and it was supposed to be like an unbelievable race. And Saratoga is like about a half hour from where I lived. But I never had heard of her. I had no interest, and I missed it, you know. I really came close.
Well, besides your serious poems, I mean, you write about everything in life, and I know you have a lot of humorous poems, like the Mad Girl poems.
Yes.
And do you have other series?
I, I did a whole lot of Madonna poems at one point, which I haven't really, you know, people keep asking to, you know, me to do a collection of those, and I haven't really put that together.
But you wrote Madonna poems before Madonna.
Right, I did. And everyone says, oh, you copied Madonna. That's exactly
no,
right.
She copied you.
Right.
Well, you weren't singing at the time, so.
No, I'd given up singing and gone on to my other obsession, which is ballet, which, believe me, I do for my own fun, and I don't do
well,
it.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. You've been doing that most of your life, haven't you?
No, I started, actually. Well, I've been doing it for quite a while, but I did not start as a child. I started as an adult, and because of that, you know, I mean, I'm obsessed with it, and I take a class every day, sometimes two a day, but, you know, I because I never started as a child, and actually, I think I had, like, about maybe three or four, maybe a half a year of lessons, but I realized even then that I just, even though people look at me, and I'm, you know, I'm thin, and they say, oh, you look like a ballet dancer, I don't have the kind of back that a ballet dancer needs, so I have no illusions. Like, there are other adults who do have illusions that if they started early, they would be able to, you know, be a dancer.
You just love it then.
I love it, and it's also, it's one of the few exercises, truthfully, that I've, you know, I can make myself go to, you know, if I join a gym, I probably wouldn't continue. I don't like skiing, even though I grew up in Vermont. You know, I wish I had I rode a little as a kid, but very little, and now I think I'd be afraid, actually, much as I love horses.
Seems like in Germany when we were riding that you were like the star of the Nutcracker a couple of years or something?
I did do the Nutcracker. I'm not a star.
A principal role, maybe?
Well, it's the first scene of the Nutcracker where they sort of get a lot of, this woman had a cast of 100, and for the first scene she would get adults who would do a little waltzing, and it was really more acting. And one year I did actually get mentioned in the newspaper for being, it was really for my acting abilities.
Oh.
You know, the three of us were picked out and I was one of them, but it was not for dancing, but it was, I played the wife of a crazy jealous husband who, there was another man after. It was tons of fun, you know.
Mm.
And I haven't done anything like that down here, but I do take a lot of ballet and, you know, I have collaborated with dancers like where they've, you know, they've done the dancing, basically, I might do just a little bit, and I do, you know, read a poem, like my Plymouth Women poems was put to dance, but I haven't been doing much of that, although I really missed it, and, you know, really enjoyed doing it.
So you're currently in Washington or Virginia?
Virginia, most of the time, although I do go back to my, you know, my New York house. In fact, I was just up there. I came back on Monday, and, you know, it's like I'm sort of between places. I, you know, half the time I don't know where something is because, you know, did I leave it up there or is it here? You know, and it's just, you know, I don't know how people live in several places.
Well, it's kind of a blessing. I also do the same thing. I have it's not really mine per se, but my partner's. We live in separate states, and there's a third house where we are on the weekends, and it's like a vacation, but you have to have two sets of things. You have to have the set where you live mostly and the set where you live, you know, kind of. So,
exactly.
But it's kind of nice to get away.
I like the part of getting away, and, you know, often we drive up there. You know, usually this last time I went up, I flew up and I did a couple of readings, but often we go up there for something to do in my house or just to make sure, and I swear the part that I like the best is sometimes we stay overnight on the way, and it's like, this is the wonderful time before I find out what's wrong with my house, you know, what's leaking, what's broken, what roof is falling off, what car won't, you know, the car won't start, and it's a really nice house, but it's in, you know, it's where a lot of the documentary was filmed, and it's really quite beautiful, but having been left so long, it has this really strange smell to it.
Oh, is that the house with the stained glass window or something?
Yes, that's right, and, you know, it's a house that has a lot of memories because, you know, my mother was alive then and my other cat, and, you know, just my past was very different, you know, and so when I go there, I feel, especially if I go there alone, it's really a very strange feeling. It's like I'm kind of almost flung back into the past.
Well, it's good and bad at the same time, but
exactly.
Mostly good in a way.
Yeah.
Okay, would you like to share a humorous poem?
Yeah, I will, yes. One of the things I always like to do is to write poetry for anthologies and actually, you know, for someone who's doing one. And several of the books came out because of that, like the Marilyn Monroe book, came from poems I wrote for Mondo Maryland that Rick Peabody edited. And then he did another collection of Barbie poems, so I wrote a lot of them. And then it became some little tiny Barbie chapbooks. And this was one I wrote, but it was not accepted, so I just had the poem. But it's called Condom Chain Letter. You get all these, chain letters. I guess now you get them more on the internet, but before I used to get them in...
Condom chain letter?
Condom chain letter. Okay. Use this condom, and then send it on to the name at the bottom. You will be rewarded in 15 days with 11 used safes. Do not discard. One man did not believe in this, and a wasp the size of New England invaded his house. Now you won't need more. Your luck will change soon. 20 condoms won't be enough for one night. Women will flock to you as if the tips were coated with something they felt and need again. You can't lose. Put this down and let your dog eat it. One man did, and his, withered to a thimble of dusty skin. A feather crows swooped down to use for their nest. That was the last he saw of it. Send 75 used condoms. Your hemorrhoids will disappear. Only your wallet and your will get bigger. Another man who threw this chain letter away lost everything that extended more than half an inch from his body to sharks. And when he finally sent it on, fingers and thighs grew back. His nose and ears, and even a little nub of a you-know-what. This is no joke. I just had fun writing that, and it's always fun to read. You might have heard, did you think you heard birds in the background?
I heard something, yes. At first I thought it was a cat meowing or something. This birds?
Crazy. I've got this one of these clocks, and, every once in a while, it's set to the wrong time, and every once in a while, it will, go on a certain time, it has a bird sound. And I remember before you call, I thought, we passed the right time, so I guess it's not going to go off. And then,
well, we have a bird clock on the porch at the third house, the holiday house. And each hour has a bird on it, and when it reaches the hour, it makes the sound of the bird that many times.
Yes.
And we call it bird o'clock, and bird 30, I think they make a sound, too.
This
is it like that?
This is the kind of thing it was. I turned off the computers, I turned everything else off, and I looked at, just before you call, I looked at the clock, and I said, But it's funny, when before you called, and I was sitting here in the quiet, I thought of one of the poetry workshops I did when I taught at Union College, and it was like to sit in a quiet room and listen to the sounds. And I realized when it's really quiet, you can hear the metro, which is, it's walking distance. And you can hear the sort of sounds of the computers, even though they're not on. And you can hear, the air conditioning. It's funny, all those little sounds.
Yes. Maybe you have written, I know that I have written a poem called Silence, and when everything is quiet, or you think it's quiet, you start listening, and there are all those sounds, the computer humming, the refrigerator, the air conditioner, the traffic in the distance, maybe the distant train, and we're never really in silence, are we?
Exactly, and it's, when this documentary of this film was done, one of the things they kept talking about was the term they called ambience, and so, if they had to retape something, then they had to actually recreate the sort of silence but that isn't silent in the back of the room. And, I never would have thought about that, but they had to spend a lot of time on that. So it was really fascinating to do the film. I'm kind of disappointed that it's not.
That's very flattering to have a film about yourself.
Well, it was really fun to do, and, it was fun to go to it, too, and it's fun to have it shown at readings, because it sort of throws light on the poems, and the poems throw light on it. And, even though it's been out for quite a while, it was on a couple of public, television stations, I know. And it's probably in a lot of libraries, too. So it's not like, that's not being distributed. But Women Make Movies, really did a great job with distributing it. And so,
well, we should mention your website, of course.
Oh, definitely, yes.
www.lynn, Lyn, Lifshin, L-I-F-S... HIN.com.
Right.
And much information about your publications and what's going on there.
And lots of interviews. And actually, it also has my email, you know, if someone wants to get in touch with me through that. It's
right.
Photographs.
Fan letters and stuff.
Maybe I'll get some more letters from the Vatican.
Well. Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been so much fun, Belinda.
And
I really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay.
I'd love to get to El Paso. I have to say that that was one of the most friendly, just warm audiences. You know, I just loved it.
Well, maybe we could arrange something.
Well, I hope so. I'll look forward to it.
All righty. We'll talk
Thank
to you later.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.